thank you for coming out on this very rainy Thursday. I do suspect with the weather that there will be some people who will be arriving, and they will be coming in through the back, so please excuse what might be a little disturbance as people make their way in for today's session. One that I'm very excited about, my name is Christian Dorsey. I'm the Director of External Government Affairs here at EPI, and we're very happy to have you here to talk about the jobs crisis, but particularly looking at the aspect of good jobs, job quality, and reversing the decline in good jobs. And I am going to deduce that from your interest in this topic, you might be also interested in coming back to EPI on Tuesday of next week, the 17th, where we will shine a spotlight on the jobs crisis and how it is having a particularly devastating impact on a number of communities. And joining us for that forum will be Rich Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, Janet Marghia, the president and CEO of the National Council of La Raza, Wade Henderson, who is the executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, Ben Jealous, who is the president and CEO of the NAACP, Deepak Bhargava, who is the executive director of the Center for Community Change. They will be joining in an extensive conversation with Larry Michel, the president of EPI, on the jobs crisis and really what a broad coalition of folks ought to do about it. But that will be subsequent to this wonderful session that we're having today. And it's my honor to introduce our moderator for today's program, someone who is uniquely qualified to guide us through this discussion on job quality and how to reverse the decline in good jobs. He is Dr. Hector Cordero Guzman, who is a program officer in the Quality Employment Unit in the Economic Opportunity and Assets Program at the Ford Foundation. And his work at the foundation includes generally focusing on identifying and partnering with organizations that have strategies to increase labor force participation and returns to work for people in the United States with marginal attachment to the labor force. Now, specifically, Hector supports organizations, programs, and strategies and initiatives that improve public policies and the infrastructure for the delivery of workforce development training to low-income people, particularly racial and ethnic minorities, immigrants, and other marginalized populations. Hector is engaged in a wide variety of partnering with organizations who are helping people improve their marketable skills, connecting workers to the labor market, and providing opportunities for those workers to hold sustainable wages. And also, a key aspect of his work is figuring out how to increase the upward mobility within the labor market. Prior to joining the Ford Foundation, Hector is an accomplished professor and author, having taught at Baruch College and also within the City University of New York system. And he is a graduate on the graduate level with his master's and doctorate degrees from the University of Chicago. So I'd like to welcome to guide us in our conversation, Dr. Hector Cordero Guzman.
Wow, that was very embarrassing, particularly uniquely qualified and coming from a foundation. Take that with a grain of salt. My job here is to introduce the wonderful panelists, and I think between today's panel, more bricks and mortar conversation, and the conversation next week, I think we all should have a pretty decent sense of what kinds of strategies are emerging as potentially helping us get out of this crisis. And this is not a derivatives conference, but it is a derivatives conference when you think about reversing the decline, right? We want to kind of slope it up. Let me introduce the panelists for this morning. First, Dr. Algernon Austin, and I'll make the three introductions and then they'll speak in turn. Dr. Austin is familiar to all of us from here at EPI. He directs the EPI's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. He's the author of the new EPI briefing paper, Getting Good Jobs to America's People of Color. And he will speak on reversing the decline in good jobs. And there are copies of the paper, of the really wonderful paper outside, and other testimony that Algernon has recently prepared and presented. After Algernon, we'll hear from Catherine Singley, who's a policy analyst for the Economic and Employment Policy Project at the National Council of La Raza. In 2009, she published a comprehensive report, also available outside, on the Hispanic workforce, fractures in the foundation, the Latino workers' experience in an era of declining job quality. And Catherine will speak to us on Latino workers in an era of declining job quality. And third, in this morning's, early morning's panel, Judy Conte, who's a federal advocacy coordinator for NELP, the National Employment Law Project. She coordinates all of NELP's federal work, including advocacy and lobbying Congress, and working with the administration and administrative agencies to implement programs and protections designed to help workers achieve the promise of economic opportunity. She will speak on an economy based on decent work. Afterwards, we'll have about 15, 20 minutes for Q&A, and we'll move to the second panel. So Algernon, please.
Good morning, everyone. So my presentation today is going to be based on the paper, Getting Good Jobs to America's People of Color. In the production of the paper, I forgot to include the acknowledgments. I want to acknowledge John Schmidt, Bill Spriggs, for reading and commenting on a draft of the paper, and also for the Ford Foundation for supporting the research. Okay, so this is the ideal. Everybody, as President Barack Obama has said, everybody just wants to be able to get a job that supports a family. It's a wonderful ideal. Unfortunately, today in America, this is not something that everybody who wants this type of job can obtain. And this is what I'll be, this problem is what I'll be highlighting today. So the next slide, please. So I'll be talking about the decline, first about the decline in good jobs. Our definition of a good job is one has three components. One, it has an hourly wage that yields at least 60% of the median household income. In 2008, that wage was $14.51 an hour. As you can see, that wage was significantly above the poverty level wage and significantly above the 2008 federal minimum wage. So it's a higher standard than both of those two things. A good jobs, in addition to that wage, also provides health insurance and provides some type of retirement plan. The next slide, please. It's working now. Okay, great. The standard of 60% of the median household income is sometimes used in international poverty comparisons, since our poverty level is not cannot be easily applied across the globe. In 2008, the National Academy of Sciences also have an alternative poverty measure, and their poverty measure based on the FCSUM refers to food, clothing, shelter, utilities, and medical expenses. Comes up to $29,654. Using the good jobs wage, at the annual earnings from that is $30,182. So this standard, the good jobs wage, is a standard that many people would consider to be a more reasonable, a better standard for a sort of a poverty level standard for a family. And I draw attention to this because it's not an extremely high wage. It's not something that should be beyond the reach of the American economy. So once we combine these three elements and look at the share of workers that have good jobs, for male workers, we see that over the last 30 years, there's been a significant decline. In 1979, 46.5% of male workers had good jobs. By 2008, last year, it was down to 31.3%. So that's a drop of 15.2 percentage points. So what we should note here is that if we continue as we have over the last 30 years, we should expect this number to keep going down. We should expect continued declines unless we recognize this as a serious problem and start working towards reversing it. The situation for female workers is somewhat better. For female workers, there is a slight increase of 3.1 percentage points. However, most of that increase, if you look carefully, really happened over the 1980s. Since the 1980s, it's pretty much flat for female workers. Although there was this slight increase for female workers, overall, for all workers combined, there was a decline. So we see a 6.9 percentage point decline over the 30 years. So again, if we continue to do the same, we should expect continued declines in good jobs. This decline is surprising when you consider that today's workers are a lot better educated and a lot more productive than they were in 1979. We just look for male workers here. In 1979, only about 32% of males did not graduate high school. So, you know, we had a dropout rate for males about 32%. In the labor force, by 2008, it was down to 12.8. So much fewer dropouts. If we look on the flip side, what percent obtained bachelor's degrees or higher? In 1979, it was about 20%. By 2008, it was about 30%. So the male labor force, much better educated in 2008 than in 1979. If we look at productivity, in 2008, it's about 70% higher than it was in 1979. So given these things, the problem does not lie in the American workforce. The American workforce is better educated and more productive, yet the quality of the jobs that they're in have declined significantly. So we need significant policy changes to reverse the decline in good jobs. It's not about the American workforce. Another way of looking at this, at what has been going on, is to look at these two occupations and their projected growth. So the orange bar refers to home care aides, and the green bar refers to computer-based jobs. The good news, well, home care aides have a median wage of less than $9 an hour, so that wage would make it a bad job. Computer-based jobs have a median wage of above $30 an hour, so definitely a good job's wage. But what you can see here is the projections for growth in the computer-based jobs are about $400,000 jobs. So we see significant increase there, but there is an even greater increase in the bad jobs of over 500,000. So that gives you a sense of what's been going on in the American economy. And the problem again here is not, we can't eliminate the home care aides. They exist, they're needed, we're an aging population, people are going to need assistance in their homes. So the goal is to how can we transform these quote-unquote bad jobs into good jobs by making the necessary policy changes. Now I want to briefly look a little bit more deeply into some of the racial and ethnic variation in the rates of obtaining good jobs. You can see the gray bar here is for, first, these are male workers. The gray bar is the rate in 1979. The green bar is in 2008. You can see for all groups of males, there have been declines. Notably, for Hispanic males, have had the largest declines. They were the lowest in 1979, and yet still had the largest decline In 2008, the rate of good jobs for Hispanic male workers is less than half of the rate for white male workers. For female workers, you can note that there's for white females, there was an increase in the rate of good jobs from 79 to 2008. For Hispanics, there was a slight decrease. For blacks, a tiny decrease, about the same. For other, an increase. The other population is relatively small. So most of the increase in good jobs for women are really driven by increase in good jobs for white women. For most women of color saw either stagnation or declines over the time period. Now, why do we see these disparities? First, one thing that's important to note is that as you move up the education levels, the rate of employment in a good job increases. So the rates for people with bachelor's degrees are much higher than for high school dropouts. Part of the reason Latinos and blacks have such low rates is due to their lower education levels. Lower education levels. However, even if you look at individuals with the same level of education, you can see that for Latinos and black workers, their good jobs rate among high school dropouts is about half the white rate. Similarly, among people who are high school graduates, the non-white workers are about half the rate of white workers. And as you move up the education levels, you still see racial disparities. So another important factor is that even at the same level of education, non-white workers are much less likely to have good jobs than white workers. And this points to the continuing issue of discrimination in the labor market. In the paper, I go into more detail about what's going on there and how that works. So quickly, what's needed to increase the share of good jobs? Again, I'm just going to do a quick overview here. The paper will go into more detail. As I've mentioned, if we continue to do the same as we've done over the last 30 years, we should expect a continued decline in the share of workers in good jobs. So we need a commitment by policymakers at the federal, state, and local levels to creating good jobs. And some of the other panelists will go into some more detail about these issues. We need a minimum wage that should be set to half the national average wage. This will put some upward pressure on wages. Although we've had increases in the minimum wage recently, the minimum wage today, in real terms, is still less than what it was in 1979. So we could certainly be doing better in terms of keeping up the sort of the bottom of the wage level in the United States. We need universal health insurance and universal retirement security. If we had both of these things, we would double the amount of good jobs in the American economy by the definition that I'm using here. We need policies that support unionization. The paper shows that workers in unions are much more likely to have good jobs than workers who are not in unions. So those are broad overviews of what's needed to increase the number of good jobs in the American economy. What should we do about the racial disparities that we see? We need a renewed commitment to addressing racial and gender discrimination in the labor market. Again, the paper goes into more details about that. We need better education and training, specifically for Latino and black workers. And we need broad reforms in the criminal justice system. There are many countries that have both a lower crime rate than the United States and a smaller proportion of their population in prison than the United States. This is very significant for blacks and Latinos who are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. If you have a criminal record, it's hard for you to find a job, and even harder for you to find a good job. So that's a significant factor in the disparities that we see in obtaining good jobs. And in conclusion, I just want to draw people's attention back to Barack Obama's statement. We need a country where everybody who wants to be able to get a job that can support a family can get that type of job. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Catherine Singley. I am a policy analyst at the National Council of La Raza, which is the largest national Latino civil rights and advocacy organization in the country. And I'm so glad to be here, and thanks to EPI and Algernon for inviting me to speak about our report, Fractures in the Foundation. The Latino workers experience in an era of declining job quality. NCLR has had a long history of working on anti-poverty and workforce development issues with Latino workers, and this is our kind of landmark report on job quality, because looking at the workforce, we understand, as Algernon pointed out thoroughly today, that Latinos are disproportionately represented in some of the lowest quality jobs in the country. And as we look at the jobs crisis today, I think it's important to have this conversation about quality, because the labor market pressures are so tilted against workers in an environment where jobs are scarce and pressures to hire and workers to get a job are so high. So today I want to give a brief overview of the demographic characteristics of the Latino workforce, which have a lot of bearing on where they are in the labor market and the kind of issues they face. I want to look at some of the structural issues that contribute to Latinos' representation in low-quality jobs, and talk about some of the policy issues and solutions that we could advance to ensure that job quality improves for all workers. So to begin with, I just wanted to draw your attention to the details about this Hispanic workforce. There are 22 million Latinos at work in the U.S. They are the fastest growing segment of the population and the labor force, now 14% of U.S. workers. They are relatively young compared to the workforce overall, and they also have the highest rates of labor force participation. So Latinos are hardworking, and they're also the most likely to be poor and working at the same time. Between 2000 and 2007, the Hispanic workforce grew by 34%, and the foreign-born Hispanic workforce grew by 53%. This is a breakdown of the Hispanic workforce by nativity. So just over half of the Latino workforce is foreign-born, is U.S.-born, and so these trends are projected to continue. The numbers are reversed here. The foreign-born population is actually 54%, although the piece of the pie is smaller in this graph here. But the trends are expected to continue that immigrants will drive the growth of the Latino workforce. So looking at some issues of human capital, which Algernon touched upon, Latinos overall have a lower level of educational attainment. This is a graph of adults who have completed high school. So we see here that compared to 92% of whites, 88% of blacks, 67% of Latino adults have completed high school. Important to note is that these disparities are much narrower for native-born Latinos. So in targeting policies, For workforce development and advancing educational attainment, it's important to focus on policies that really reach foreign-born and oftentimes limited English proficient workers. So where are Latinos in the labor market? Overall, it's important to know that Latinos have the highest, are most overrepresented in the service sector. They're about 20% of service sector workers, which is where we find a lot of the low-quality jobs and the jobs that are projected to grow as America continues to, as the nation continues to grow in the service sector rather than the manufacturing and production sectors. Latinos are more likely than blacks and whites to work in small businesses with less than 25 employees. About 29% of whites work in these in small businesses, 21% of blacks, and 36% of Latinos are in small businesses. And then also, Latinos have a high presence in what we consider contingent jobs and sort of non-traditional jobs. So we're talking about workers who don't expect their jobs to continue. That would be contingent workers, so who don't have the security and the expectation to maintain income over a year, over 2 years. And then also non-traditional jobs. We're talking about day laborers, independent contractors, in categories such as this, where the kinds of protections and benefits for workers are often non-existent or are different because of the laws that protect workers. So here you can see some of the occupational groups that are heavily dependent on Latino labor. Latinos are about 40% of workers in the farming, fishing, and forestry, triple F category. Building and grounds maintenance, Latinos are about 33%. Construction, about 30% of the construction workforce is Hispanic. Production occupations, about 20%. And then food service, the last one here is 21% Latino. So this is kind of, this also can help us to target some of the occupations that Latinos are overrepresented in and also that are seeing some of this, the slipping in job quality that we see. And what are those indicators of low job quality? Definitely low wages. I mean, that's kind of the first and perhaps most important indicator. 2 out of 5 Latino workers earn poverty-level wages in our country today. The benefits disparities are outlined in the paper. Latinos have the lowest coverage from their employers providing health insurance and retirement plans. Also the lowest unionization rate, and really what compelled us to write this report is the highest workplace fatality rate and the kinds of injuries that don't get reported because they don't kill a worker but are still severe and have long-term consequences. So in... So in 2007... Over 5,000 workers died on the job in the U.S., and 937 of those were Hispanic workers. And as you can see, since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has kept data in the consistent manner that it has since 1992, Latinos, which is the top line here, have seen the highest rates of fatal occupational injuries, the highest rate of death on the job. This is an issue that we think deserves much more attention than it's been getting. The fact that workers are still in danger at work when we have health and safety laws on the books is a matter of life and death and something that is just morally reprehensible in a country that, you know, is considers itself advanced and developed. These are higher rates, I should point out, than some of our counterparts, our other developed countries that the International Labor Organization keeps track of. We're talking about England, France, Germany. The U.S. still surpasses those countries in their rates of fatal occupational injuries year after year. So where did the erosion of job quality begin? Algernon talked about declines in more recent years. I think it's important to consider also the larger restructuring of the economy that's been going on since the late 70s, a shift to, since the 70s, a shift to a lower paying jobs, increase in the kinds of workers that work in non-traditional arrangements, and definitely the growth of subcontracting, which I know Judy and NELP have done tremendous work to kind of expose the lack of accountability in subcontracting arrangements. Immigration policy has also had a tremendous impact, both on the Latino workforce and the quality of jobs overall, quality of jobs for workers. A significant portion of workers does not have a voice on the job because they're afraid to speak up. And this is because there are few legal channels for workers to get here, especially low-skilled workers, and they're left with discriminatory and discrimination on the job and kind of just a culture of fear. And then finally, to consider the slowdown in labor law and the lack of attention to modernizing laws so that they cover the workers and the workforce of today. I'm going to list these out, but I'm running out of time, so let's kind of, I guess, go into these more in the question and answer. These are some of the major issues affecting job quality that we see for Latino workers in particular. I'd like to point out that intimidation and intimidation of employees and the consequential underreporting of injuries, underreporting of wage theft and wage violations is rampant in a lot of the occupations that we pointed out and is really compounded for immigrant workers, regardless of their legal status, who are so reliant and dependent on keeping the job that they have. And then the groups of workers who are simply missed by current laws, gaps in legal protections for small business employees, for the 400,000 Latino agricultural workers, domestic workers, which is a whole category that we could talk about, and then, of course, the 8.3 million undocumented workers. And we think that government can be doing more with more resources. The Department of Labor doesn't have enough data on what are the high-risk industries and firms. And there is a big problem that between the enforcement of immigration laws in the workplace and the enforcement of labor laws in the workplace that really is a disadvantage to anyone who speaks up on behalf of workers. And also the grievance process for complaints is treacherous, especially for workers who don't have the knowledge and the know-how to navigate the system. So some broad categories for improving job quality, and we can go into more detail in a minute, but definitely improving compliance, holding employers accountable for the laws that are already on the books is important. Making the punishment fit the crime so that fees and penalties for employers who break the law actually mean something to them. Getting involved with community-based organizations is particularly important for reaching Latino workers, both in educating workers on knowing their rights, but also identifying those high-risk industries, identifying those high-risk firms, and rooting them out and really lifting up employers who are doing the right thing. And we also believe that closing some of those coverage gaps in legal protections that are long overdue would go a long way to improving job quality for workers. And so I'll stop there, and we'll go into more in question and answer. Thanks.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Judy Conti, the Federal Advocacy Coordinator at the National Employment Law Project. I am the low-tech member of the panel. You're just going to hear me speak. I don't have a presentation. But there are some materials outside for those of you that also want to get your hands on something or see something visual. NELP is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, and we've gone through many transformations over our lifespan, but at this moment in time, I think it's very safe to say that our work is all about creating good jobs, working to enforce the job standards that are already on the books, looking for ways to leverage private and public money and investment to create and maintain good jobs, and to create a safety network for workers so that when they are between jobs or when they need to be educated and trained to receive better jobs in our new economy, that we're there to help advocate for those policies as well. So I'm very grateful to be asked to speak here today, and I thank Algernon and his colleagues at EPI who do such a great job leading the way on a lot of these issues. I'm going to add a couple of things to Algernon's opening statement about what is a good job. I agree with everything he said, and I would add two more things, and I'm just about 99.9% certain he would agree as well, even though there weren't things he mentioned. First is the notion of a career pathway. We don't want to get people into dead-end jobs. There should be an opportunity for continued skill development, for advancement through either the present workforce that you're in or the opportunity to move up in another workforce or in another workplace, and not just the concept of being in a sort of a dead-end position that maybe adjusts for inflation from year to year, but there is no other potential for growth. And the other thing is something very intangible, but it's the concept of dignity and respect, that your work is valued in your workforce no matter what you do, whether you are the highest or the lowest on the totem pole, and that you are always treated with respect for the important role that you play in that workforce. I think we've seen a lot of trends that have led to the decline of good jobs over the years. We're seeing an ever-increasing shrinking middle class, as we all know, and the vast majority of people who fall out of the middle class fall lower and are not raised up higher. And the co-panelists have gotten at a lot of the reasons for this. I think an increasing obsession with profit at all costs, regardless of what it does to our workers, is an intangible piece of the social science behind what's happening here. And a decline of sort of we're all in it together mentality. You know, again, we are increasingly a nation of haves and have-nots. And people don't see that necessarily as a bad thing. You know, socially, the thing that made our greatest generation so darn great was this notion of a community, and you lift one person up and you lift everybody else up. And that is a notion that's increasingly falling away as well. The decline of union membership is without doubt a key part of the problem. And over the last decade, we have seen in particular a Department of Labor that has really stalled, to put it mildly, and been failing grossly at its job to protect especially the most vulnerable workers. And we know that when the most vulnerable workers are taken advantage of, that just rises up from the bottom. And the more vulnerable the lowest of the low-wage workers are, the more vulnerable all hourly-waged workers are, and indeed all workers are in general. In order to start to put together a way to attack these problems, NELP has worked on a number of fronts. Over the last 2 years in particular, and we just released in conjunction with some key allies, the report is out at the front, a report called Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers, where for the first time, as opposed to speaking anecdotally about all of the wage violations and workplace violations that we know to be rampant, we have tried to quantify it in a real scientific sense. So for a period of 6 months, we had questioners, investigators out there talking to 4,000 low-wage workers in Chicago, New York City, and LA, from all walks of life and all different types of low-wage industries, and asking them very particular questions, not to get their conclusions about whether or not they had been the victim of any sort of workplace violations, but designed to allow, you know, experts, legal and economic and social scientist experts, to evaluate raw data and find out what kind of violations are prevalent in these industries. And the results, I think, were shocking even to those of us that have been working in this field for years. And the lesson is that this is not limited to a few rogue employers or to the periphery of the economy. It's happening everywhere. And in particular, in a lot of industries where there is still growth that are central to our economy, such as home care workers, restaurant workers, construction, cashiers, laundry, security guards, you name it, it's happening. Let me just give you a couple of statistics. In 2008, 26% of the workers were paid below minimum wage. 76% were not appropriately paid for overtime. They either got nothing or not the time and a half premium that they were supposed to receive. 70% of workers were not paid for work they did off the clock when they came in early or stayed late. 69% had meal break violations. 41% had illegal deductions from their pay for work-related tools or materials. Only 20% of these workers that we surveyed made complaints or tried to organize a union. And of those who complained, 43% of them, almost half, experienced some sort of illegal retaliation. The rest didn't complain for fear, all the reasons that Catherine pointed out so amply. This, I thought, was the most shocking thing. Of all of the workers who had a serious on-the-job injury, only 8% of them filed for workers' compensation. And 50% of those who did faced some sort of retaliation. So we know from this that we've got a real problem here and that we really need to turn the tide. And NELP is working in a lot of ways to leverage public and private resources, government money, and the effect that government money and government agencies can have on the private industry in order to change the tide, and we have a number of recommendations. The first I will start with is really the most intangible, and that is I would love to see the Secretary of Labor, and in fact the President, the Vice President, all levels of the administration, use their bully pulpit to really speak strongly and extol the virtue of all work and how valuable any of that is in our society. I would love to see a world where, quite frankly, we rid ourselves of the phrase low-skilled worker. I don't know about you, but I have worked as a waitress. I've bussed tables. I've scooped ice cream. I know people that have emptied bedpans, have worked on assembly lines, have caddied, have shined shoes. There isn't a bit of this work that doesn't involve skill. Right, different levels of skill, different levels of education, but all work is skilled work and needs to be valued as such. And when we get ourselves back to a type of people that value every contribution people make to our economy, I think we're going to start seeing some very big improvements. We do have some very good laws on the books. We need to enforce them. Over the last year, on three separate occasions, GAO has issued reports that have really drastically condemned the Department of Labor and the way that it handles and investigates wage complaints that it receives. They are utterly failing low-wage workers, and they are utterly failing hourly workers in general. There's already been some fabulous improvements in that area. There have been over 250 new employees added to the Wage and Hour Division at Department of Labor in just the last year alone, and I know that upward trajectory is going to continue. And they are really looking at being much more vigorous in their enforcement. We recommend that in addition to accepting complaints and investigating those, that they also engage in targeted investigations aimed at the industries where we know that rampant violations exist and aimed at the highest level of contractors that subcontract and subcontract again, get as high up the food chain as possible to change that behavior. As with Catherine, we recommend they partner with community groups. There is a whole network of worker centers and legal service providers and other advocates throughout the country who are on the ground and know intimately where the violations are happening. And that is an important resource that the Department of Labor can use, because no matter how many investigators there are, they will always be under-resourced in this fight against wage theft. In terms of government jobs and government-created jobs even more broadly, there's an awful lot the government can be doing. First of all, there need to be some tremendous prevailing wage reforms. There are a number of laws that require in the construction industry, in goods industries, and service industries, when federal money is going out to create jobs in terms of government contracting, that people be paid a prevailing wage. But the way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates the prevailing wage has really been stunted since the Reagan era, and we need to do a lot to update the calculation method in order to make sure that the wages and the benefits that people calculate truly are prevailing wages. In terms of government contracting more generally, this administration has an opportunity to really change the way that the government does business, to require that contractors pay living wages, to screen out aggressively those contractors who violate wage standards and the other requirements of their contracts and don't pay workers' compensation, don't pay into unemployment compensation, misclassify people as independent contractors. And the government could also either require or at least strongly incentivize by creating preferences for contractors that provide good health benefits, that provide for sick leave, that have practices that really help sustain people in their role as families and providing for those families. The federal government can do more to require that the money it gives to state and local governments to provide services and to hire people, again, are used to hire people that have these kind of good jobs that we're talking about. There's a number of loopholes that the government can work on closing up. You know, Catherine has talked about and alluded to some of them. Two I will mention are agricultural workers who are, you know, because of an outmoded notion that all of the farming or the vast majority of the farming in this country that's done is on the smaller family farms, a lot of these workers are exempted from all sorts of wage and hour, health and safety, and retirement protections that we hold very dear to our workforce. Home health care workers are also exempted from minimum wage and overtime work. This is a huge sector of our economy, as others have discussed, and it is one of the growing sectors of our economy. And it is one that is largely staffed by women. So we are creating jobs that continue to impoverish women, very important jobs in our economy. So the Department of Labor can reverse a very misfounded regulation that considers home health care workers exempt from overtime and minimum wage and do a tremendous amount to turn these kind of jobs into good jobs. I would echo Algernon's comment that we need to raise the minimum wage, make sure that it's pegged to the average wage base in this country, which at its historic high was 50% of average wages. If it were at that today, it would be roughly $9.30 an hour as opposed to the $7.25 we have now. I think we can all agree that still isn't a living wage, but it'll raise a lot more wages up because the minimum wage not only takes the minimum wage with it, but it lifts up all of those other wages that come near the bottom of the wage scale. In terms of the minimum wage, what we also need to do is change the tipped credit minimum wage. Tipped workers have been frozen at a salary of $2.13 an hour for decades. And it creates a dynamic where disproportionately service workers occupy a larger percentage of those living in poverty than workers in many other fields. And there are disproportionate impacts with both race and gender there as well. So just to conclude, and I'd be happy to take questions on it, we really do believe that there is a lot that the Department of Labor and that the administration can do to lead the way on this. There is a role in contracting. The government needs to be involved in creating jobs both in-house, taking back the jobs that it has outsourced over the last year, but also in terms of the kind of contracting that it continues to do and must do, creating jobs that have the kind of standards that we consider as good jobs. And if the federal government leads the way as the employer of choice and leads the way showing what a good job looks like, it will also create very important levers on private employers to meet those standards as well so that they can compete for the best workers out there. So thank you very much.